thank you very much for your kind words. A very warm welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to tonight's meeting with David Crossman. A meeting too with his latest novel, Frau Ortflucht, for a bericht. I do not know, David, whether it has already an English title, because the book has not yet been published in English, has it?
Yeah. First of all, shalom and good evening, and thank you all for coming. The book will be published in 3 months' time in English under the name Till the End of the Land, because Ora, the main protagonist of the book, she wishes to go to the end of the land, but of course it has a double meaning when it talks about Israel.
The title, yes. Just the scenario for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I'll give a short introduction. I'm afraid I'll have to repeat a few words already said by Valerie, but not many, trust me. And then David will read a few pages in Hebrew so as to give you the idea of how his sounds like in the original language. And then I'll be asking a number of questions. 75 minutes is the maximum. We'll see how far we get. David Crossman is, as you know, not only one of Israel's leading writers, but internationally renowned writer as well, and indeed translated into 25 languages, which is quite a feat, Dutch, of course, being one of those languages. I believe that, and David will correct me if I'm wrong, all his fictional work and most of his essayistic work has been translated into our language. A few examples. You must know, I'm sure, Sie Liefde, the book that was published here in Belgium in 1986, the story of little Momik, who tries to understand, who tries to cope with the trauma of the Holocaust, which he sees all around in his family, and a fantastic book. Later on, there was the Grammatica van het Gevoel, and I've just pulled a few books from our library. A very wonderful story, that Zigzag Kind, where again a young child is the main character. Haar Lichaam Weet Het, in fact, a collection, if you like, of two novellas, which try to dig deep into, well, all the nooks and crannies of the human psyche. And then, of course, there is Op de Vlucht voor een Vrouw, Op de Vlucht voor een Bericht. David Crossman has also collected a basket full of literary prizes, both in his own country and abroad. And he's also a doctor honoris causa of, among others, our own Catholic University at Louvain. David Crossman, ladies and gentlemen, is praised for his stylistic virtuosity, his mastery of the language. Le mot juste, certainly, but also, and pardon the pun, le mot joli, the word beautiful, as Oscar Wilde might have said. But he's also equally and rightfully praised for telling challenging, painful, moving stories, praised also for tackling pressing contemporary political issues, and for weaving a complex yet subtle plot that not only explores the most secret thoughts and feelings of his characters, but also demands from you, the readers, utter concentration, making him in this sense a writer that perhaps rose against the stream of those easy page turners that flood today's market. It is therefore an amazing feat, I can say, that Een Vrouw op de Vlucht voor een Bericht is both a gripping, penetrating tale, as well as an unsurpassed page turner. This may seem strange, because the storyline on the face of it seems straightforward. Ora, who's just brought her son off her to a military meeting point, is going to be another Israeli military action, invites her one-time husband Avram to come on a walking tour with her, as she wants to stay away for as long as Ofer is in mortal danger. Avram reluctantly agrees to set out on this long-distance footpath, avoiding all news of the war on the one hand, on the other hand excavating the history of their relationship and their relationship with Ilan, her other man, the other man in her life. By focusing on the life of her two children, Aram, conceived by Ilan when she was with Avram, and Ofer, who conceived by Avram when she was with Ilan. Now that I come to think of it, the plot doesn't seem too straightforward. But I can safely tell you that this book is truly magnificent, and I can also safely tell you that Ruben Verhasselt, the translator, has done an equally magnificent job. David Grossman, I think you have always a well-defined idea about what the book should contain, the theme, the major themes perhaps. Was it any different this time?
I think I wanted to describe or to document two layers of life that intrigue me all my life. One of them was, of course, to describe our situation in Israel, in the Middle East, the situation of war, of occupation, of terror, of living our life constantly immersed in fear, in danger, in violence. But I was not less, and I think even more interested in trying to picture one family. I'm fascinated by families, like I think all writers. And I think that the greatest drama of humanity is the drama of the family. And always I believe that the most important events in the human history, they did not occur in battlefields or in parliaments or in palaces, but rather in kitchens, in bedrooms, in children's rooms. There were and there are the greatest dramas. And I thought, if I could combine the two, if I could write about a family, and if I could show how the outer situation, the brutality and the cruelty of the outer situation, how does it radiate itself and effect and infects this very tender bubble of the family, the bubble of intimacy and warmth and caring. Living in Israel allows me, as a kind of unlikely privilege, to witness the changes that life under fear, that it brings about individuals, society, and also how it affects the family itself. How it affects parenthood, for example, the relationship between parents and their children, when we know that at a certain age the child will go to the army. How it affects all walks of life, the amount of violence within the most intimate relationship, how it affects the language. And this is what I try to do in this book, to tell this story. And so much of the story is about family, because what Ora does when she runs away from home, she doesn't want to wait for the announcers, that she's afraid they will come to announce something bad that might have happened to Ofer, that she took to the army, as you very well described. At the beginning she stays at home, but then suddenly she realizes that it takes two for bad news, one to deliver and one to receive. And she starts to ask herself, what if she will not be there to receive? You know, it's a very strange thought, but in such harsh moments, one tends to think in a very magical way. And she believes that if she will not be there to receive the bad news, all this machinery of the bad news, of the announcement, it will be taken aback. It will be withdrawn for a second or an hour or half a day. And so many things can happen in this half day. She believes she might save her son. And then she almost kidnaps Avram, that you mentioned, who was the boyfriend and the love of her youth and maybe the love of her life, and she starts telling him stories about Ofer, all the smallest details from which we accumulate a child in the world, you know, taking him or her to the dentist or to the football game or studying mathematic homeworks with him, all these small little efforts, all this huge investment that we are doing, and by that we accumulate him, we create him into a mensch, into a human being. And she feels that now when he is in the battlefield, and when there is danger hovering above his head, the only thing that she can do in order to infuse life and strength into him is to tell his life story. And this is what she does. Okay. It's a long answer. Yeah, but
understand this book is rich enough in theme, the family and fear in this particular case of a mother for her son, that this interview will be almost exclusively about these kinds of questions. But before we continue, David, may I invite you to read a piece and tell the public where in the book or what book, what your fragment is about.
I will read for 2 minutes, no more than that, just to allow you to listen to the melody of the Hebrew. And it is while Avram and Orah are walking. They are walking in the Galilee of Israel. It's a very long walk that they are doing. It's the Israeli Trail, which is a very beautiful course in Israel. And I did it myself for the writing of this book. And she talks to him all the time. She tells him. Avram, may I add, in the beginning is very reluctant to hear. He doesn't want to have any contact with her family, with Ophir. Avram, who was like a sparkle of light and life and imagination and passion, when he was 21, he fell captive in Egyptian captivity during the 73 war, and he came back quite broken person in his mind, in his body. And he doesn't want anything to do with life. I mean, he cannot bear to be exposed emotionally to life. His hard disk is totally full with pain. And of course, if he becomes attached to Ophir, it will hurt him. Because, I mean, feeling something towards somebody exposes you. There's a lot of pleasure in that, but there might be some pain if something happens to this person. But gradually he is tempted to know more and more about Ophir and to be carried towards Ophir because of the way she tells the stories. And here she tells about how she breastfed Ophir when he was a baby, how he and she were alone at night, and this intimacy and this feeling that she saves him from death in hunger, because you know babies when they are hungry, I'm sure what they experience is fear of death. They don't know if they will survive. And how she feels that she's able to survive, to help another human being to live through her own body. Oga medaberet. Yesh hi meifa mabat ורואה ששפתיו נעות אחרי המילים שלה, כאילו אברהם מבקש לחרות בתוכו את דבריה. היא מספרת על הלילות הארוכים שישבה בכיסא הנדנדה עם עופר על גופה, כשהיה חולה, לוהט, מיוזה, נרעד מדי פעם ופולט יבבה. היא הייתה נרדמת ומתעוררת איתו חליפות, ומדברת אליו רכות, ומנגבת את הזיעה מפניו המעונות. אף פעם לא ידעתי שאפשר להרגיש ככה כאב של מישהו אחר, היא אומרת, ומציצה באברהם, כי מי כמוהו ידע פעם להתמלא עד שפתו, בכאב של אחר. ועל ההנקה היא מספרת, איך במשך חודשים ארוכים התקיים עופר רק מחלב שלה, ואיך היה משוחח איתה שיחות שלמות במלמולים ובמבטי עין בתוך כדי שפה שלמה, עשירה כל כך, היא אומרת, שאין בכלל מילים לתאר אותה. היא רוצה שיראה גם אותה שם, לא רק את עופר, עם חזיית ההנקה המוכתמת והשיער הפרוע, עם הכרס שבמשך חודשים סרבה להיספק בחזרה, עם חוסר האונים הנואש למול מחוביו המסתוריים של עופר, הבוכה, הצורח, עם העצות הדוקרות של אמא שלה ושל השכנות המנוסות בהרבה ושל האחיות בטיפת חלב, עם העושר על שהיא בעצמה במו גופה מקיימת יצור חי,
והרגעים התהומות שבין זעקות הרעב של עופר לבין הרגע שהתמתה נבלעה בשפתיו, וכשזעק הייתה רואה איך גופו קורץ לבת אחת, כגוף שיודע שהוא עומד לטבוע. פחד מוות זרם לתוכו במהירות, היא חשה בו חולף לידה, פחד מוות מילא את חלליו הריקים ממזון, הוא צרח, הוא ביקע את עצמו, עד שזרמים קצובים של חומר חיים שלה באו ומילאו אותו אט אט, ואור של הקלה נגע על פניו הקטנות. הוא ניצל, היא הצילה אותו, יש בכוחה.
Thank you very much.
Anyone understands Hebrew here? Yeah? Hi, Erev Tov, Shalom.
I'll be asking David a question or two about language, because it's crucial in his work, the way the words sound as well, not only just what they mean. Before that, David, I know it's a painful question, but you were in the middle of writing of this book when your son Uri was killed at the last days of the Second Lebanon War in 2006. Did you continue to write? Did the death of your beloved son have any effect on the final outcome of the book?
It's I even don't know how to answer this question. I wrote it for 3 years and 3 months, and then it happened. And I went back to writing this story immediately after the 7 days of the Shiva, of the lamenting that we have in Judaism. I did it because I felt that this is my way to be in this world and to understand and to keep some sequence of myself. When something like that happens in one's life, the basic feeling is a feeling of exile. You are exiled from everything that you know, everything from your own body, from family, relationship. There is such a deep cut in life. And I felt that instinctively, I mean, I explain it now, but instinctively I think I felt that going back to writing will allow me to create a place for myself again in the world that has been shattered, and to create a home for me again in this place. From the very beginning of the writing of this book, I knew that the ending will remain open, because I think it's always much more true to life, to leave open ending. And in that sense, nothing has been changed. So I think what I can say is that the story has not been changed, but the writer has.
And does the writer think then, like Ola in the book, who says at a given moment, honestly, when she's writing in her notebook, honestly, she says, who would have thought that writing does so much good to the person?
Yeah, I think, at least for this person, it does a lot of good, because this is the way I know to understand myself, and this is the way I know to explain things that otherwise I can never explain. And I don't know how many of you experienced writing, but there is such a sweetness to this state of mind that you start to create something that didn't exist before, and step by step, with a lot of stubbornness and resilience, you manage to create a reality that sometimes is very hard to believe. It's totally incredible in the simplest meaning of this word. And yet, if you yourself believe in it, and if you infuse all yourself into it, other people will come and believe in that. And I think I always think I'm so lucky in that sense, because, you know, so much of our life is dictated by coincidences and by arbitrariness and by people who are totally irrelevant for us, just
Try to think for yourself, how much of your life is being dictated by people who are totally irrelevant, that if you had a choice, you would never invite them for coffee, and somehow they have this terrible influence on your life. And when I write, I can enjoy so much, again, this sweetness that everything is relevant. Everything that I do is because somehow it is relevant to me in a way that maybe I didn't know or didn't realize beforehand. But here there is this character who in the beginning I really didn't want to write and was not interested, and I asked what it sticks to me. He glues himself to me and doesn't allow me to sleep and comes and pop out in all the unexpected moments. And if I surrender to it, suddenly I realize how much I am this character. How much it's only another alternative option of myself, that just by coincidence I was spared sometime from being this other one. And what a pleasure it is that one can be so many others. You know, I think that usually we are so protected from others, isn't it? So, you know, I'm not talking about being protected from enemies, which maybe there is some logic to it, even though I think it's wrong. I think it's very important also to expose yourself to your enemy in order to change the situation between you. But I suspect that also among the most friendly people, you will see this instinct that keeps us from being totally exposed to the chaos that prevails in the other one, even if this other one is very beloved. I sometimes look at, say, married couples, present company excluded. Of course, here in Brugge you are wonderful couples, everything. I'm talking about Jerusalem, okay? But I look at couples who are married together for 20, 30, 40 years, and they are wonderful couples, and they love each other, and they function wonderfully as a family, and parents, etc. And yet, if you look into them, you can see two things. First, you can see where they have been, where they have congealed and became obscure to each other, where they do not allow the other to advocate all the wholeness of them. As if sometimes I can look at such couples and I bereft them of all these layers of time and age and difficulty of life and tragedies. And I can suddenly see, even in elderly people, the two young people that they have been when they were 19 or 25, and I see the moment of their creation as a couple. And sometimes you even can see, if you know these two characters, two people, you see how they, at this very moment, as if they had a deal, a bargain. They said, our love will win at any price, but there is also a price for that, because they decided not to see the other from all the points of view, because some things are frightening and threatening and irritating, and they don't want to be exposed for that. And you see it also, even as parents, I think, how much we are reluctant to expose ourselves truly to the dark corners of our children, to the places where they are strange for us, not decipherable. This is so threatening for us. And sometimes we think that when we make love, we really know the other. Yes, in biblical Hebrew, we even say to know a woman, and Adam knew his wife Eve. Adam yada et chava ishto. But of course, in these moments, we are much more tuned to the more what sweet, beautiful, sexy parts of our partner. Yes, we do not want to think at this moment about our partner as someone who is miserable or tormented or irritating. So it means that even in those most intimate moments, we do not really know the wholeness of the other. And when I write, my movement is just in the other direction. I totally want to be invaded even by the others I write about.
I want them to evocate within me all their options. And when that happens, and when I succeed in that, and I cannot say that I succeed in every character, I wish I did, but I cannot. But when I do, it is really, you know, this, again, that the sweetness of this totality is overwhelming.
It comes slightly as a surprise to me that you talk about the sweetness, because I remember you once said that writing is mainly suffering, except the Zigzag Kid, which you enjoyed writing. And was it a half joke then when you said, you know, it's normal that I should be suffering, after all, I'm a Jew?
Yeah, that was as a joke, but I write it, not that I'm Jewish, it's this is true, but that I like suffering. I think that you misunderstood me, because it was never and never is, even now, no matter how painful the things I write about, it's never only suffering. It is, I mean, of course there is an amount of suffering, because writing means to crack down everything that was safe in your life, and to bereft yourself from every defense mechanism, and to see what will happen out of that, you know, to put yourself in front of the harshest situation and to see how this stuff of your soul is going to react. In that sense, it can never, ever be very easy. But at the same time, it is such a pleasure, and the energies of creation, and I think the passion with which myself, and I'm sure that you as a writer, you feel it, that the passion with which we wake up in the morning and knowing that we are going to spend some more hours, you know, struggling and trying to solve all kind of small and big riddles.
That's true, yes. It's a very difficult job indeed, and you can call it suffering, but it's the kind of challenge that you've got to meet and overcome in the end, I understand. I'm talking now as a literary critic for a moment, if I may. Perhaps it's in my interpretation, but I had the impression that the first scene of the book, which takes place in an isolation ward during the 1967 war,
yes.
And the three main characters are then put forward to the reader. It's Avram, Ilan, and Oran. Am I right in saying that you sort of made a mini version of all the themes in the first scene?
Yep. I think so much is concentrated there, is encapsulated there in this primal scene. The relationship between the three of them throughout their life, even their destiny in a way, the personality of the three. It's a kind of prologue. It takes place in this isolation department in Jerusalemite hospital, just when the Six-Day War started. I wanted so much to create a situation in which three young Israelis will be totally isolated from the wave of fear and later euphoria that flooded us all. And I remember it so vividly. I was 13 then, and I remember the deep existential fear. I was sure I'm not going to live after this week. Israel was a nation of 3 million people surrounded by 250 million Arabs that were furious with hatred towards Israel. We listened to the Hebrew speaking radio station from Cairo, Voice of Thunder from Cairo, that used to promise us that they will come and they will slaughter us and rape our mothers and sisters and throw all of us into the sea. In a very serious way they did it. You know, it was quite real fear for a Jerusalemite child who went and took some swimming lessons in the YMCA in Jerusalem to be prepared for when I will be thrown into the sea. I thought I'm not trained enough for that. And the miraculous feeling of being saved suddenly when the war ended with our victory. And all these feelings are encapsulated in this, 60, 70 pages, that it also takes place in total dark. We had to darken the windows, afraid of air raids. And I remember it also very vividly, but this part of the book is written in a way as a radio play. And it was always a dream of mine to write literature as a radio play. I have to say that from the age of 9 I was a radio actor in Kol Israel, in the Voice of Israel. And I played in, I think, thousands of radio plays. And I so much love this genre. I love the intimacy of the radio and the fact that you have to imagine everything. Everything depends on the voice, yes, of the human voice. I was so young then that I didn't even reach the microphone of in Kol Israel, in the Voice of Israel, and there was an empty orange box it was called Grossman's box, and I used to stand on it in order to reach the microphone. And in the first tenth, I don't know, of the book, it is this atmosphere of a radio play in the dark that the reader has to create a story with me.
I'm not going to read to you, trust me, all the different themes that I saw an inkling of in the first scene, and it's certainly not an exhortation to you to stop reading after the first scene. I mean, the book develops richly from there onwards. My last question as a literary critic, some people say, you know, this is David Grossman's magnum opus. How do you react to that? I mean, books are like children to a writer, and parents always say that they love their children equally dearly, even if they lie. Do you like all your books equally dearly? And is this just another book in the wrong series?
You know, exactly as each one of my three children gave birth to me in a way that I didn't know before, and made me in a way, and allowed me to feel things and to understand things that I could not have understood otherwise. Each book does the same to the writer. And in that sense, I cannot say that one is more important than the other. I mean, when I'll stop writing sometime in the future, and I will look at all the books, I will know, I think, at least I feel it now, each and every one of them was essential for a certain period or a certain sentiment that I wanted to express. And I don't know what I will write next. So I'm sorry, I cannot give you a very satisfactory answer.
I understand that it doesn't concern you. I mean, it's what
it
other people say.
It really does not concern. I think there is such a difference between the experience of writing and being within a story, and, you know, diving into it for 5 years, 5.5 years, and this is all your world, and this is what really allows you to be in this world. Between that and the way it is regarded from the outside, it's always painful, you know. Even sometimes when people very much love your work, you all the time ask yourself, maybe they love me for the wrong reasons, maybe they hate me for the right reasons, they don't know. But the basic thing is this intimacy between the writer and the book. This is why I so much love long processes of writing, because it is like a couplehood, you know. I change the book, and the book changes me and allows me to be more and more things that I could not have achieved otherwise.
Then the book is published, the readers read it, the readers react, the critics react. How do you react to those reactions? I mean,
well, the best thing that can happen is that I get reactions that are tuned to the book. This is a very good feeling of, you know, overcoming the inherent loneliness that one feels. If I feel that people read it and it talked to them and it changed things within their inner life and gave some names to feelings or sensations that were mute or without a name before, it is so wonderful. I remember the Israel Book Week we just celebrated last week and this week, and I was standing in the stand of my publishing house in Tel Aviv,
And the young couple came to me, and the young woman said, "I have a story for you. Would you like to hear?" And I said, "Yes, of course. I like stories." And she said, "You see, this is Asaf. This is my boyfriend now. We met 4 months ago, and we liked each other, but I had to go for another 4 months to the United States to conclude my studies. And we didn't know if we shall be together. So we decided that we shall buy this book, A Woman Escaped from the News, and we shall read it separately, and after 4 months, we shall tell each other what we thought." And when he told me what he thought about the book, I decided that he is my kindred spirit. And I immediately told them that I'm willing, even to be in a very tactless way, I told them I'm willing to be responsible for the children's books department if anything happens to them in the future.
It's a very interesting sort of fan mail, really. Do you get many letters from... I know that you receive letters even from Japan, I believe, for some of your books.
I receive letters. I even answer every letter that I understand the language, not every language I can. It's a good feeling. It's really, you know, once I remember when I was writing the book of Intimate Grammar, or The Grammar of the Feelings. It is a book about a little family in Jerusalem, like my family, actually. And before the book was published, I thought it would be just fair to let my parents read it. And I gave it to them, and my father read it, and he said, "Well, it's a very nice book, David, but do you think that someone out of our family will be able to understand it?" And now, whenever there is a new translation from China to Japan, I come and I tell you, "See, Abba, Daddy, they've understood." And in a way, for someone like me who never really is very sure about his place in this world, I think these reactions, they create a place for me, and I like the idea.
Yes, you're here in Bruges today, tomorrow in Louvain, then it was Salzburg, I believe.
Yeah.
And next one, after that?
Florence, yeah.
You're Florence. You know, you accept a lot of invitations. Is that because you've got such a nice character that you don't dare say no to invitations?
No, don't be misled by my looks. I'm Dr. No. I mean, I say no many times a day, but this book is a book that I want to accompany. It's very important for me, you know, to ship it into the world, and I like to be with it whenever it's published in another language or another country. But usually most of my life I sit in one room, actually, from very early morning, and I write, and this is actually the perfect situation for me.
But you wouldn't go as far as a Moroccan writer I encountered a couple of months ago, a poet, in fact, Abdallah Zulikar, who said, "You know, I've got nothing to say about my poems, just read them, please."
Ah, okay, that's a good deal, but I don't feel like that, actually, and since I feel that usually I put in the book the smallest part of what I could have said about it. Look at this book. I feel I like coming and talking about it, and talking about the characters, and suddenly it gives me a feeling that they are totally alive, that these characters are real human beings.
Mm-hmm. Language is all important, the way with words is all important to you. Even the names you choose very carefully. Why did you, for example, choose Ora? What does it mean in Hebrew?
Ora means light, luce, yes, like the light we have here. I like the word, I think it suits Ora because she's illuminating. And she illuminates all the men around her, mainly the men. She has two sons, and her husband Ilan and Avram, the love of her life. And she acts upon them in many, many ways. And Ofer is a beautiful name. And I always can work only with names that I like. Even for characters that I dislike, I must choose names that I like. And Ofer means in Hebrew the Bambi, I don't remember the word, the son of the gazelle and the deer. But Ora says that before she gave him the name, and she hesitated what name she should call him, she tried this name, the Ofer name, and she tried to think of the melody of it in different circumstances, and she even went that far to think how women in bed will whisper his name. But of course, she also had in the back of her mind the word Ofer in English, which is almost a sacrifice, yes. And
it's the same in Dutch, offer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Offer means sacrifice.
Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah. Silly of me, but I couldn't help it. When I saw the name Ora, and then as the story developed, I was raised as a Catholic, and Ora pro nobis, pray for us.
Oh.
And I thought, well, that suits her too. I mean, it's got nothing to do with what you had in mind. I understand that. But it's kind of her, the book is her prayer for the safe return of a son, if you like, and the safe return of a relationship with Abraham.
Yeah, I didn't know that, of course, but I think it suits her. And what she does in the book, while she tries to save her son, actually she's saving Abraham. She brings Abraham back to life. She revitalizes him by the power of the story that she tells him, and by her very personality. And I also think, because she managed to take him, almost kidnap him, with her to the Galilee. And the Galilee, I don't know how many of you have been to Israel, but the Galilee in the north of Israel is one of the most beautiful places that I know. And it's flourishing, it's green. Dramatic landscapes. And I always think that if Avram and Ora had to settle all their problems and to talk it out, if they did it in the protected room of a psychologist, probably it would have taken them years. Being in the out, being in the generosity of the Galilee, it opens them immediately. And I can testify, because when I went and I did this walk, I met several people there on the way. Not many people did it when I did it back then in 2003. And most of the people that I met were settlers, young settlers, because for them it's a declaration. They say, this is our land, we are going to explore it with our own feet. We do not go like the children of the leftists to South America or to India to explore these places. We are from here. Now, these people, had I met them in any other circumstances, it would have evolved immediately into thunders and lightnings. Meeting there, in this nature, in the softness of this nature, allowed both of us to be so open, so disarmed. And I did another thing. I decided before I went to this long tour, trip, I decided that each person that I will meet, I will ask him or her two questions. One question is, what do you regret in your life? And the second question, what do you long for in your life? Now, they seem to be very easy questions. Believe me, they are not. And it was amazing to see, how immediately people gave this answer to me. I thought it would take them an hour for me, just to choose between all the regrets of my life. But they immediately gave me that, really, with generosity. And the fact that they gave me such really intimate stories of their life, and I put it in the book. In the book, there is this character,
Akiva.
No, it's the doctor of the children. I don't know the name. He has no name actually in the book. And he goes, and he has a reason for doing so, and he asks the people what is their regrets and longings. And I invite each and every one of you to think of it later at home. And all the answers that are in the book are authentic answers. I wanted to have this Israeli choir of different voices and different stories in the claustrophobic walk of Ora and Abraham.
Talking about those different voices, My impression after I had finished the book was that religion and the Holocaust were, first of all, not your priorities, but were practically totally absent. There's only this one encounter with the pious Jew who dances and sings and enjoys himself all the time, and just a short reference to Ora's mother who was in the concentration camps and survived. Why so little about those two all-important themes to the Jewish state?
But basically because both Ora and Avram are secular Israelis, religion is almost irrelevant for them. Like for, by the way, most Israelis, I know that from the out it seems that all of us are ultra-Orthodox. Not at all. The great majority of Israelis is secular, absolutely secular. We are kidnapped by the religious institution and by some messianic hallucinations, but basically the people, individuals, and the society, majorly secular. And I didn't want to go to dig too much in the Shoah, because I felt that the echo chamber of the Shoah, it exists so much in Israel, you don't have to point at it. And maybe also because in Sea and the Lab, I wrote a whole book about the Shoah, and I understood some things, and I wrote it already for myself, so I didn't have this, you know, energetic or urgent fuel that I need to feed on. So this is the answer.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Avram Burg, well, I believe he was used to be the president of the Knesset?
Yeah, the chairman of the Knesset.
The chairman of the Knesset. What did you think of his book, that Israel should leave behind the legacy of the Shoah?
Yeah. I think that he was carried away with this theory. Of course, I find it dangerous to become addict to the state of mind of the Shoah. I think that if we nourish and strengthen and emphasize the idea of our victimhood, it's very, very dangerous. And it happens quite often to peoples who become prisoners of their national narrative or historic narrative. Historic narratives are very important, of course, and they create an identity. Sometimes they become like a trap to you. I do not believe that we can forget the Shoah, and I don't want to forget the Shoah. The Shoah was maybe the most significant catastrophe or trauma for humanity, I think, not only for us Jews. I think that every human being, even if he or she is not a Jew, must ask himself or herself, what I would have done had I been there as a Jew and as a German, or Lithuanian, Ukrainian, Polish. It is, I think, a simple moral responsibility that we must ask ourselves, as a victim, for example, what I could have put in front of total obliteration of myself as a human being. I always have this idea, there is this Jewish belief of the luz. Luz is this very little bone in the backbone up there. You have it, you don't have to try it. Trust me, all of you have it. And we believe that in this little bone, all your personality, the essence and essence of your personality is kept. And this bone cannot be crushed or burned. And during resurrection, in doomsday, the human being will be recreated from this loose. We are all losers. Yes, we have it. And I always, the second homework that you have to do is to think, what is your luz? What is really the very essence, the pupil of the eye of your personality, the last thing that would remain of you, that you will be able to be recreated from? And in See and the Love, in this book, I ask this question, you know, as an individual, had I been there, what could I have done in order to maintain myself, my individuality, me? And the second question was, In such terrible times, would I be tempted to collaborate with this massive, enormous wave of brainwashing, of lust, of hatred, of racism, of aggression? Do I have some things to protect me? Will I be honest enough or courageous enough to see exactly when I start to collaborate with this machinery of evil? Because this machinery is so tricky and so cunning, and usually you do not understand to what extent you are part of it. And I think all these things are too important to be forgotten, to be overcome, as my friend Avram suggests.
Mm-hmm. Talking about your authorship, you mentioned a few questions about that. You feel unsure about some things when you sit down to write. Avram quotes Aschenbach from Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, and he says, a translation, my own one, I'm afraid, "The fear of the artist that his life could end before he has given himself completely and utterly." Is that also the fear of you, of the writer, that he knows that he's fighting a losing battle, in fact?
All our life is a lost battle, because in the end we shall die, but what we do in this life is what gives it significance, meaning. No, I don't feel it's a lost battle. I feel, you know, sometimes I can be desperate to think that the things I deeply believe in are not accepted by many more in my country, for example. But it's okay. I mean, I don't really think in such terms. I want to tell a good story. That's the basic thing. I think this is always the basic, the primal motivation of every writer, to tell a good story. And it is such a desire, I think, such an instinct. The instinct that we have to tell stories is something so wonderful. It's amazing how from out of the millions of data and information that pour to us during the day, immediately we know that this certain data is a story. It has the nature and the quality of a story. And how do we know it? First, because we feel immediately that it falls into a place that as if awaited it in our mind and our soul. And second, it generates immediately the urge to tell it to someone else. Immediately you call on the cellular, you say, "You don't believe what I just saw. You know, this is a story." And it's so wonderful that this passion to tell stories always meets the opposite passion, the passion to listen to a story, to hear a story. And this, I mean, all the other questions about, you know, life, lost battle, all that, that's it's too much, too big.
It's also how the story is told. I'm sure some of you, most of you perhaps, have already read the book. Those who haven't will find out, just as I did, I think, that there's such a richness of metaphors and images and just a beautiful way of saying things, flu and smooth. It all seems very natural, yet I wonder, is it hard work, or do you pull these things out of, like a magician pulls rabbits out of the hat?
It's hard work to start with. It's a combination of hard work and sudden ideas, you know, sparkles. But usually it takes me a lot of time. I write and rewrite and rewrite many, many times, as if I have to peel all layers of cataract from myself until I reach the place that I really want to describe, the thing that will be totally accurate and precise. It's hard work, but I mean, in the coal mine it's much harder.
Is it also your attempt to, as you once said, to recreate the, or to get back, to recover the authenticity of the language?
Yes, because so much of our language is being manipulated. I can testify for Israel. By the way, it's quite warm here, isn't it?
Yeah,
but I feel I'm already medium rare, so if someone can change that.
I'm sure there's no heating on, it's just body fluids.
Okay. Especially when you live your life in a state of war and of fear like we do. Ah, thank you. Thank you very much.
I hope there's not a draft now. For some, if you don't have a draft, it's going to be awkward.
In such situation of hopelessness, mainly of aggression, the first thing that is being manipulated is the language. It's manipulated by the government, by the army, by the media. It's so easy to see how another whitewashed language that really is created in order to buffer between the citizen of this drama and the actions of his army, of his government, not to expose him to the harshness of these deeds. And there is this language that is a false language. In the end, it does not tell us about reality. It obscures reality from us. And I remember when I was writing The Yellow Wind, I went in 1987, before the First Intifada, I was sent as a journalist of an Israeli newspaper to write about the reality in the occupied territories in the 20th anniversary of the occupation that started in 67. And I went there and suddenly I felt I don't have words to describe it, because for years I was fed by the manipulation of the systems, and they fell short to describe the complexity, the terrible reality that I witnessed there. And I had almost to invent a word. And I believe that if you use your own words, if you do not succumb or subjugate yourself to the general language, you can change things. Suddenly you call things with your intimate names, your private names. And suddenly this reality that you describe, it is not the cliché reality that you were manipulated to believe in and therefore to do nothing to change it. It is a reality that has a lot of relevance to your life and to your future and to the future of your children. And you can move in front of it. You don't have to be paralyzed by it, because the basic feeling of Israelis and Palestinians is that they are totally paralyzed, that they cannot do anything to change the situation. And it freaks me out to think that we are in this situation, especially regarding Israel. I think Israel is such a superpower. We have the best air force and the best army and the largest army, and still we feel so hopeless and helpless in front of the events, so paralyzed. And I think Israel was created that we shall never be victims again. Never be victims again. And look at us, with all this might, all this power, and still we feel victims in the sense that we do not dare to change the situation as much as we can. I do not claim that we can change the whole situation. And I do not try to idealize our abilities or our partners or our enemies. Not at all. The Middle East is a very tough neighborhood. It's the most violent neighborhood on earth today. And the Middle East never has internalized Israel. Never Arab countries have accepted the right of Israel to exist there. Don't forget that. And even when there is peace, hopefully, I mean, the greatest wish, Israel will still have to keep a very strong army all the time, because, as I keep hearing it from Palestinian and Egyptian friends and colleagues, without army, Israel will not survive there. Maybe it's hard for you in West Europe, in almost pacifist West Europe, to understand it. But this is the drama and the tragedy and the contradiction almost of our life there. That we have to find a way, and I'm not sure we have found it, to be together at the same time, a very strong state military-wise, and a very strong democracy, very egalitarian democracy. How to be, if you want, how to be together Athens and Sparta. I'm not sure we found a way to reconcile that. And I am not sure that we are very near to approach a peace solution to the conflict there. I'm sure only about one thing, that if there is not a peace solution there, then we are really doomed. We, the Israelis, and our partners. The direction we are going towards is a very destructive one for us and for the Palestinians. And you can see it in all walks of life, and you even saw a terrible example of it last week in the raid on the boat. Which is also, if we want to be really fair, is not a very simple story. It is not a simple story. And I am very much towards the releasing of the blockade over Gaza. I think it's terrible to have a collective punishment on 1.5 million people hoping to either remove the regime of the Hamas, that like it or not, and I don't like it, but it was elected democratically, or to release our beloved, precious prisoner of war, Gilad Shalit, who is kept there for 4 years, and not even once the Hamas allowed the Red Cross to visit him. He's in total isolation for 4 years. And yet, I think that the first step that Israel should do is to remove the blockade. And having said that, I would also add that the more we hear about the details of what happened there in this boat is very problematic. There were many, many people there who were really humanitarians, idealists, people who deep in their heart wanted to do good to the Gazatians. But there was also a group there that was very determined to manipulate these people, these idealists, and to create a situation of war as we saw. What really is difficult for me is to see how Israel fell into this trap, how Israel collaborated with their plan, and they did it because they knew in advance the way Israel will react. They knew that we are trapped in this aggressive reaction, that we do not have this room to maneuver and to act in a more clever, more sophisticated way that would minimize the damage for the people on both, and also for Israel as a state.
This dilemma, if I may call it war and peace or peace, also fueled, of course, part of your story. I mean, Ola walked this beautiful trail. The land is fantastic, breathtakingly beautiful. They think their land is a miracle. Yet at the same time, she sometimes says, you know, we don't stand a chance. And Ofer whispers in her ear, if I am killed, please leave. What kind of person does this kind of split personality create inside a person?
Well, it's, in a way, it is a natural thought. You know, if you see no hope for the future, if you see no future.
Ora is a mother, but she knows that her son is not only her son, but it will also be the army's son, yes. The state's son.
Yes, and this is the reality of our life. You know, in the 50s, when someone gave birth to a child, she would say, I gave another soldier for the state. Thank God this is over, yes, but if you live in a situation that the army is so important for your survival, in the end, the army becomes an end for itself. And it's very dangerous. The army becomes the most dominant part of the policy and of the mentality. And all these are things that I wish will come to an end when we have peace. Again, not that we should not have to have an army, as I said. But the place of the army, the mentality of vigor would be reduced. There will be less dangers. There will be dangers. But there will be less and less dangers gradually. We shall be able to create the mechanisms among us, among the Palestinians, that are more dialogical, that are willing to work together with each other. We are very far away from it. What we have now is only the belligerent, the aggressive elements on both sides. They doom us to continue this vicious circle. We do not even believe in the option of peace. Even the word shalom, that once was such a wonderful word, today it's regarded as a password of those naive leftists, of what is left of the left. May I just say that, you know, I think we approach the end of our talk.
If I may ask a final question, perhaps. I don't know what time is it. Have we already? Yes. Because it was my original intention to really say or ask you something about Ora, who is the engine of the book. It struck me, I mean, all parenthood that I realize is at best stumbling in the dark, but she's so harsh on herself, she thinks she's a bad mom. Is this, you know, I know that you always want to create individuals, but is this also a type of Yiddish mama?
Maybe there are like her, but I think many mothers, especially when they just gave birth, they felt this fragility, this insecurity about themselves as mothers. Maybe they doubted their ability to act according to the instinct of motherhood. Maybe they felt that these instincts have degenerated in them already. I think always it is that the children that are born to us, they, as if they open again a crack in our identity that has recovered partly over the years, that we learn to live with this crack, and children are tuning themselves in a magnet act to the very cracks of our identity, and they impose upon us to repeat all kind of sins, family little plays that probably go in a family for generations, but we do not know it. And we are doomed to play this role. I remember myself also as a father, how insecure I was when my kids were very small. How
there's a Yiddish daddy as well.
Yiddish, I'm a Jewish mother as well. I'm a very motherly father. I'm not sure that it's over until today when two of my kids are quite grown-ups now. The book is very much about motherhood. I really try to understand motherhood. I thought that it will be a mother that will tell the story of raising up of children in the best way, because the contact between the child and the mother is so primal, much more primal than the father and the child. Again, and I'm very involved father, and yet I know that it was different between my wife and our children. And I also thought that only a woman will think of this idea, even though a man had written it, but a woman in the book will think of this idea to escape from the bad news. Because in so many women that I know, there is this slight skepticism regarding those big systems of the government, the army, the war, those big men's games, systems that were created by men, and mostly they reward men. And maybe it's more natural for a woman to say, stop, I will be more loyal to my motherhood than to the state. And that's exactly what Ora does.
Yes, she yearns for a normal life. Is that the same for David Grossman? Do you think that that will be possible very soon?
Very soon, no. As I said, I don't feel that very soon I will enjoy normal life in Israel, or that Israel will enjoy normal life. Even if there is peace, we shall probably experience a lot of turmoils, because peace means that there has been a very painful compromise, and a painful compromise indicates a lot of frustrated, rageful and vengeful fundamentalists on both sides that will try to assassinate this fragile peace. But I deeply believe that this is our way to start to live the life we deserve to live. We are deprived of our real life for a century. I say we, I mean the Palestinians and the Israelis. And, you know, I wish from the bottom of my heart, I wish for the Palestinians to have their state, independent and sovereign state, and to raise up children without fear, and to experience life without the humiliation of being occupied, they have been occupied by us, by the Jordanians, by the British, by the Egyptians, by the Turks. They never knew one day of liberty. And it affects also the inner liberty. If you all your life or generations live under the humiliation of subjugation. But for me as an Israeli and as a Jew, the most important thing is to see how Israel will start to recover from all the distortions and wounds and traumas of our history. And I think that if we have peace, we can explore so many more layers of life. Now we just survive from one catastrophe to another. Just survive. All our history, we survived to live our life, and now we survive. We live to survive only, no more than that. And this is not enough. Life can suggest so much more than survival only. If we have peace, we shall have first, you know, we shall have borders. It's so important. We don't have fixed borders. Every decade our borders are moving. You know, it's like to live in a house that the walls are mobile. You never know where you end, where your neighbor starts. Every reaction becomes over excessively and reaction or over defensive, which is aggression. And there is always a temptation to invade you. I want a border that will allow us and the Palestinians to crystallize our identity, not only vis-a-vis the conflict, but vis-a-vis ourselves. A border, not a wall, a border with gates to allow people and trades and ideas to commute. And when we shall have that, we shall have a feeling that we can have a future there. You know, we do not really believe that we have a future. If you read in an American paper that America plans the graves or the roads project for the year 2030, it sounds perfectly normal, but no sane Israeli will make plans for such a long time in advance. You feel a click, a pang in your heart, as if you violated a taboo by allowing yourself too much quantities of future. Having peace will allow us to have borders, place. I always feel that a Jew is someone who, by definition, never felt at home in the world. Even in the most friendly, hospitable places, we never really felt at home. Israel is meant to be our home, yet it is not. Only peace will bring about that. Only when we have that, we shall have this solidity of existence that we never have experienced. This deep conviction, belief in our being there. And I don't know what your political opinions are, but I'm sure many of you will agree that it's much more important, all these things, more important than being the dominators or the occupiers of this hill or this valley in the occupied territories. Thank you.
Thank you very much.